This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to The Books Podcast with Sam Leith.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm proud to be joined by Adam Sisman, a very distinguished biographer, most recently of John le Carré, but who in this case is more of an anthologist and editor. He's about to publish the second volume of the, well, not collected, but the selected.
Selected, exactly, yes.
Of Patrick Paddy Lee Fermor, called More Dashing, after the first one was called, I think, Dashing for the Post.
Exactly, which is how he often signed off his letters. He always seemed to be writing in a rush. And indeed, in some of the letters, he actually describes the postman drumming his fingers as Paddy desperately adds a last postscript.
That's sort of writing to the moment, isn't it? Now, this kind of overlap, it's not a sort of second volume in sequence, is it? I mean, it's...
No.
So was it something you didn't anticipate when you put together the first one and then, as it were, you realised there was this appetite for them? And,
no, on the contrary, I did anticipate. And for example, I realised that there was a magnificent sequence of letters between Paddy and Lady Diana Cooper. One could, in fact, have made a volume solely out of those, just as there was a volume of letters between Paddy and Debo Devonshire in Tearing Haste, published in 2008, I think. So there were enough letters in that correspondence to make another volume of a similar size. And I didn't want the first volume to be distorted by having too many letters of any one type. So I was already thinking then, putting letters aside and thinking, we'll have that in the second volume. And indeed, the first volume then produced, as it were, what is the right metaphor? I don't want to say worms coming out of the woodwork, but suddenly a whole load of people wrote to me saying, I've got a letter from Paddy, I've got it. In fact, they still are doing, and I'm now wondering whether to do a third
volume 3.
Because he wrote so many letters. I estimate in the book that he must have written somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 letters in his lifetime. And in each of these volumes, there's about 150 letters. So you can see they're very much the cream from the top of...
It is kind of, in a sense, I mean, that in itself is something slightly extraordinary and slightly of a vanished age, isn't it? I mean, I've always been concerned myself with this idea that the collected letters, you know, you think of, you know, Amos and Larkin or Lowell and Bishop or, you know, all these sort of correspondences, Teddy Hughes's letters, for instance, that have become a really important part of a kind of writer's life and afterlife. They must be on the way out of the literary genre, do you think?
I suspect they are on their way out of the literary genre. I mean, one practical reason why Paddy wrote so many letters is that he lived in a... Well, first of all, he didn't have a fixed address for the first almost 50 years of his life. And then when he did have a fixed address, it was in a very remote part of the Peloponnese where not many people came to visit. And telephoning was, at least for the first 20 or 30 years, very difficult. So to keep in touch with his friends, he was forced to write to them. And anyway, he liked to write to them, and sometimes writing his letters became, as it were, like a draft for a book. For example, his letters that he wrote on a trip to the Andes were made into a book, or the letters that he wrote to his future wife from a series of monastic retreats that he went to became a book, one of his earliest books. So he tries out his ideas in his letters. I actually think that one should, perhaps I'm anticipating something you may say later on, but one should consider his letters as part of his oeuvre.
Well, obviously for, you know, people of a certain generation, he is a sort of towering figure. There are a lot of people probably under 30 who would, you know, fairly sketchy about who this guy was. I mean, because he was a sort of... He's a distinguished travel writer. He famously kidnapped a Nazi. But how would you describe him? I mean, how would you explain his sort of place in the history of letters? Because he's...
I'm not sure I'm equipped to explain his place in the history of letters, except that as a letter writer, he's one of the best. I mean, John Julius Norwich, the dear late John Julius, who was better equipped than I am to judge, puts him right up there with the very best, with Byron or Madame de Stael or other great letter writers of the past, Horace Walpole. I think that the sheer volume of his letters and the fact that he became so practised and so adept in them, and the personality, the very sunny, sweet-natured, boyish personality that comes through them is what makes them so pleasurable to read and makes them as readable in 2018 as they must have been in 1950 or 1960 or whenever they were written.
Now, since the publication of the first volume, you said letters from others have started to kind of come out of the woodwork. Have you found, you know, new lovers or new, you know, comrades in arms? Or...
Alas, no new lovers. Though some more letters to the old lovers, some of them rather frisky. But, I mean, for example, there's a very amusing letter I found to Elizabeth David in an archive I hadn't looked at before in an American university. But also people have written to me. So, for example, his French translator wrote to me, and Paddy wrote some interesting letters to him about the difficulties of translating works between French and English, and he was very concerned about that. He himself,
when he was younger, he tried to translate a novel.
He had translated works from French to English, and he was concerned about translation both ways and about what gets lost and what can be preserved. And his letters are very interesting on that score, and on translating Proust and other great writers.
For someone who sort of got kicked out of school and, you know, led a sort of slightly dilettantish career, he was very, very learned, wasn't he?
He was very erudite, yes. I mean, I think you can tell that in some ways he doesn't have the apparatus of higher education in the sort of very analytical powers that perhaps a university education gives you, but he certainly was enormously widely read. One of the reasons is that he took with him on his great tour the Oxford Book of English Verse, which he could quote great chunks of from memory. But he read constantly throughout his life, and I don't know, probably read for 2 or 3 hours a day right through the rest of his life.
Actually, I think of the very first letter here, which is, I think, one written by him younger even than the first letter in the previous book, where he's writing with the younger sister of a friend.
That's right, yes.
And
Biddy.
He's saying, I mean, it just sort of drops in, I've just opened, you know, been to the bookshop or opened the post or something, and he's got a sort of entire Gibbon, and, you know, it's a Gibbon, the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and there's something else equally.
And he loves discussing.
He's 19, isn't he?
Yes. And he loves discussing these works with other people who've read them and some of his correspondents shared that. Not Deborah Devonshire, it was a great sort of joke between them that she never read a book, and particularly never read his books. he'd say to her from time to time, "They're really quite good, you know. You really ought to try them." But she never did.
No, I think you say the collection of letters of Diana Cooper are sort of livelier because she was a better writer.
She was a better writer, really, than Deborah. I mean, Deborah was quite amusing in her way, partly by acting dumb, but Diana was an altogether more formidable and educated person. And so Paddy raises his game correspondingly.
Do you feel that the personality he projects in the letters is the real him, or is it a persona? I mean, is he...
Not entirely. I mean, one of the things that's clear is that he did suffer from periods of depression and feeling that I don't mean to say that he felt that he was a fraud, but he felt that he was always unsure about the praise that he received, and he was also unsure about the credit he received as a war hero. I mean, his most famous operation that you alluded to earlier, the kidnapping of the German general who was in command of the occupying forces in Crete, General Kreiper, led to some pretty horrible reprisals, and many Cretans were rounded up and shot. Was it worth it? And that went on troubling Paddy all his life. What I think happened is that one of the things that motivates Paddy in writing the letters is reaching out. He seems to kind of psychologically imagine the character, the personality, the person that he's writing to, and that in itself kind of makes a kind of form of contact, and you feel this in the letters. You feel that he's reaching out to them, and in a way cheering himself up by doing so.
So he's sort of solitary and gregarious at the same time.
Yes, but it is more than just communication. It's a kind of form of engagement. It's of warmth. And as I say, that's what makes the letters so enjoyable.
Do you think he's better in his letters than he is in his published books? You sort of seem to hint.
I do, actually. Yes. I mean, I feel that some of his books are a little bit overwritten. He did rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. He was an absolute nightmare of an author. There are
Penelopizing, I think.
Penelopizing, George Seferis, his Greek friend, the Nobel Prize winner, wrote to Paddy's partner and future wife, Jones, saying, "I fear he's too much Penelopizing." And that meant undoing every night what he'd done in the morning. But in fact, and also endlessly rewriting. So poor old Jock Murray, who published all his work, had to deal with manuscripts which are the like of which I've never seen before. But the point is really...
He was always apologising to Jock Murray as well, wasn't he? I can't see you because I still haven't delivered your manuscript.
He had a real anxiety about finishing and a difficulty with finishing. And of course, he never finished the great trilogy of works about his walk across Europe that begins with A Time of Gifts, continues with Between the Woods and the Water. And
it started, it was in the run-up to the war, wasn't it, that he first...
In the mid-30s, he set off. I can't remember if he was still 17 or just 18, but he was at that sort of age. He'd not long before been expelled from his public school for being discovered holding hands with the greengrocer's daughter. Doesn't seem that bad to me, but they later were very pleased to welcome him back. But anyway, he set off on this romantic, and it is very much a romantic great trudge, as he called it, going to the the place that he called Constantinople, but along the way encountering and witnessing a Europe that was soon to be swept away, first of all by Nazism and then by communism, a Europe in some ways was not much changed for centuries, and you know, that reached back to the Middle Ages. And the
that links him to Byron in another way, doesn't it?
That's well, it does, yes, it does, and Hellenistic, romantic, and also an ability. I mean, he loved hobnobbing with quality and stayed in lots of schlosses, but he was also at home with ordinary, simple people and sometimes slept under the stars and sat round campfires with gypsies or travelled with bargees on the Rhine. I mean, I address in my introduction to my book whether or not Paddy was a snob, and I think if he was a snob, he was a snob of the most innocent kind, that he may have perhaps been rather more interested than he should have been in aristocracy, but he didn't look down on people.
As you say, the only proper snobbery you indicted for is his views of the Queen were maybe too...
Yes,
other respect, he was kind of healthily teasing.
But. Yes, well, he did love the company of duchesses too, there's no doubt at all about it. And some of his best letters are written to all these grand ladies, you know, like Debo Devonshire, like Diana Cooper. And he was very interested in genealogy too. Not quite so interested as his friend Ian Moncrief, whose interest was ridiculous. But nevertheless, perhaps more interested than most. But as I say, he was also the kind of person who could walk into a simple taverna and soon have everybody in the taverna singing. Even in 2016, when I went to his house and met people in the village, they remembered him ordinary people with a tear in their eye. You know, Paddy, oh, we so miss him. There's a very, you know, he was a man who inspired great affection.
I mean, there seems to be something sort of faintly contradictory in this thing. On the one hand, he was complete perfectionist, he was penelopizing. On the other hand, he was constantly apologizing for being late. He was constantly distracting himself, presumably from the real work of producing his books, by writing these letters. I mean...
Yes, and I think that in a way, perhaps posthumously, I'm resolving that dilemma, because I think that if we consider the letters to be part of his oeuvre, there isn't a problem. And the fact is, at least my belief is, that the letters are more spontaneous and fresher than some of his overworked published prose. That's not to say that, say, The Time of Gifts isn't a wonderful book. It is a wonderful book, and it's comparable in its feeling of a young man's experience with, say, Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. Actually, they're very comparable, and they set off about the same time, only they came from slightly different backgrounds. But nevertheless, he does give you that feeling of what it's like to be young and not caring. It's very refreshing to read.
Yes, is he, the thing is, you say, he's constantly apologising. Do you think he felt apologetic? And do you think he was tormented by the fact that he didn't write back to people on time, that he was...
Oh, yes, I think that was genuine. I mean, part of it was politeness, but I think he was always worrying about not finishing and about... I mean, he was long after everybody else had given up hope that he would finish the trilogy of The Great Trudge. He was still writing letters to people saying, I'm going to get down to it, I've just got to clear my desk. And poor Paddy by this time was suffering from tunnel vision. He could hardly see the papers on his desk, and nobody thought that he was going to finish, but he was still worrying about it into his, you know, 10th decade. In a way, it's sad, because you feel that he should have been able to rest and enjoy his last years rather than being nagged all the time by this urgency and this feeling of a task not completed.
Now, you say that he showed, you know, the less attempting to entertain, attempting to kind of project warmth and appetite for life, you know, he showed a bit more of himself in his letters to Joan, his wife. What was their relationship like? Because they were apart an awful lot, weren't they? I mean,
they were apart an awful lot, and they had a very unusual relationship. They didn't get married until, I mean, you referred to her as his wife, but I mean, they'd been together for 20 years before he got married, more than 20 years. And they had what I think is generally described as an open relationship, even after his marriage. Sometimes, certainly Artemis Cooper says in her biography that Joan would sometimes give him money in order to go off and find a woman.
What, give him money in order to travel to find a woman, or for...
Well, to go off that night and find... Yes. And he had several, perhaps more serious in a way, he had several love affairs while he was living with Joan. And certainly one of the women who I've interviewed who's still alive, Lyndall Passerini Hopkinson, as she now is, was astonished to find when she went to visit Paddy and met Joan, that Joan wasn't in the remotest bit jealous. She knew that Paddy had these love affairs and didn't mind.
Why was that, do you think? Is that sort of aristocratic hauteur on her part?
She came from that posh bohemian world of the 1920s and 30s. I mean, she'd had lots of affairs. She'd been much pursued. She was a very beautiful woman. And although I don't think she had any affairs once she was with Paddy, she understood that was the way things were. And she also knew that he would always come back to her. There is an element of the boy husband, the boy lover. And one of the things that sort of that's slightly odd is the fact that she is funding him all the time. He never had much money, and she's shelling out for him. Even
he was always funny, wasn't he, about the fact he never had much money? He'd always say, Captain Sponge has, succeeded again.
Yes,
I'm
Mr.
on the
Sponge.
Catch.
Yes, Mr. Sponge. Yes. One of his favourite books was Mr. Sponge's Sporting Tour, the 30s book, and he would openly describe himself as Mr. Sponge. And indeed, he loved going to stay with Debo Devonshire at Lismore Castle or at Chatsworth or whoever, around a series of grand houses. He's very good at getting himself invitations and indeed singing for his supper. I mean, he would be entertaining. Some people found that irritating, and it's certainly true that I have met people who found him objectionable. They thought he was a social climber and a sponger. That's maybe true, but nevertheless, I don't think it comes through in his letters, or in his letters he seems to me innocent, essentially a sweet-natured person who is genuine. There's no deceit about him.
There's a lovely quote, and I don't know who it's from, but maybe it's from him, about his appetite for life being like a sea lion throwing a bloater or something. There's a description of this.
Oh, gosh, I've forgotten that one. but he could easily, yes. I mean, he was, he did, in fact, compare himself with Byron, and he swims across the Hellespont, as Byron did. But when Byron did, Byron was, I can't remember, in his 20s, I think.
Yeah.
When Paddy did, he was 69.
Oh, we should all end up that way. Anyway, Adam Sisman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. Very much hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.